here, as you can see.
No. Board. Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order this morning. It is Monday, the 13th. We're going to start off with a couple of really quick work sessions and then move on to our informational hearing on minimum wage. So with that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3487.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure you heard last week, it's the measure brought to you by Representative Huffman. It requires licensed investigators to include their name and their license number on advertisements, and there are no amendments before you.
No amendments. Thank you. Could we have a motion?
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 3487 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Tim Barton moves House Bill 3487 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, could we have a roll call?
Representative Beretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative
Estabrook?
Aye. Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative
Bird?
Aye. Requires investigators.
Aye.
Right? Ready to go?
Aye.
Excused.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kimmerer?
I don't
aye.
Aye. House Bill 3487 having received the votes is passed, and we'll have Representative Huffman carry that bill. Close the work session on House Bill 3487. Open a work session on House Bill 3501.
Chair, committee members, you heard this bill last week, brought to you by Representative Hack. It revises the voting requirements for certain actions related to the formation or conversion of benefit companies. There are no amendments, no revenue, no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Could we have a motion?
Yes. Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 3501 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Barton moves House Bill 3501 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Beretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Estabrook?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Bush?
Aye.
Excused.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3501, having received the votes, is passed. And we'll have Representative Hack carry that bill. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3501. And we'll open an informational meeting on minimum wage in Oregon. And we're going to start off with Representative Barbara Smith Warner and Representative Rob Nose.
Mr. Chair, is the mayor from Monmouth joining us at the same time, or just the two of us?
I think just
the two of us.
Yeah, I think just the two will bring. I think.
Okay.
I'll bring them up next.
All right, I'm going to go first. So, good morning, committee. Chair Holvey, Vice Chairs Barton and Kenemer. For the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is inner southeast and northeast Portland. And I'm here today because working Oregonians, many working full-time, are not making enough to provide for themselves and their families. Over 400,000 Oregonians are struggling to survive and support their families in low-wage jobs. Minimum wage workers, if they work full-time, only make $19,240 a year. More than half of all minimum wage workers are women. Now, according to the United States Department of Agriculture, Oregon, we have one of the highest rates of Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, commonly called food stamp participation in the United States. In the year 2013, approximately 1 in 5 Oregonians received food stamp benefits monthly. At the beginning of 2014, approximately 197,000 SNAP enrollees had worked in the previous year. These working Oregonians urgently need a raise. Now, let me take a moment to dispel a few myths about minimum wage workers in our state. First, I've heard it said that people working in these jobs are teenagers or in their early 20s, just starting out in the workforce. National data shows that among those who would benefit the most from raising the minimum wage, well, their average age is 35. I've also heard people say that those working minimum wage jobs are just starting out their careers and don't have major responsibilities or dependents. This is also not the case. Again, the average age of a minimum wage worker is 35. Census data shows that in the years 2010 through 12, over half of all low-wage households were headed by women with children, and one in three of those households is below the actual federal poverty level. I've heard some opponents say that minimum wage jobs are simple, easy jobs, the kind that people have before taking on something more complex or more lucrative. Unfortunately, according to the Oregon Employment Department, over 80% of low-wage jobs are clustered in just 23 occupations. They include sales and retail, food preparation and food service, child care, janitorial and groundskeeping, home health aides, preschool teachers, and automotive attendants, among others. Honestly, I can't imagine anyone thinking that these jobs are simple or easy or unimportant. Interestingly, many of these industries are also extremely profitable. Accommodation and food service, retail trade and healthcare and social assistance, the three industries employing the most food stamp recipients, each made over $1 billion in corporate profits in Oregon in the year 2012. I think raising this wage is vital. Nationally, from the year 2009 to 2012, the top 1% of income earners in our country captured 95% of the income gains over that time period. Meanwhile, personal income tax data from our own Department of Revenue shows that the bottom 75% of income earners saw a decrease in their real income between the years 2002 and 2012. And data from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics also backs that up and shows that real wages for most workers in Oregon have declined over the past decade. Now, I've signed on to several bills regarding the minimum wage, so I'm not going to pretend that I know the best way to raise it. I just know that it needs to be raised, and I look forward to having that conversation with all of you so that we can figure out which is the best bill and the best way forward. I'd also like to close with these two thoughts. I know that this issue is controversial, but I believe we all care about the working people in our districts, regardless of our party or our occupation or our background. I also believe that we all feel that all work and all workers should have dignity. By dignity, I mean that a person's work is worthwhile, no matter what their work or profession or occupation might be, and that it should pay enough to provide for that worker and his or her family. The need for the innate dignity of workers and their work, I believe, speaks to our collective sense of civic responsibility, our sense of fair play, and for many of us, our personal faith. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I represent House District 45 in Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I am honored to join you today in this discussion about how to give Oregonians a raise. Because in order for Oregon's economy to thrive and remain competitive, we need policies that support good jobs and reward hard work by paying our workers enough to support themselves and their families. When people work full-time, they should be able to afford basic necessities like food, a home, and a life for themselves and their children. While we're discussing a range of options, as has been mentioned, a raise to $15 would have a positive impact on 589,000 low-wage Oregon workers and would pump $3.2 billion into the state economy. I believe that increasing the minimum wage will put more money in the pockets of working Oregonians, which will in turn give small businesses more of what they need most, customers. Increasing the minimum wage has an enormous and immediate impact on our economy. These increased wages aren't for building up savings accounts or investing in the stock market. The raises these workers get will go right back into the economy. Tens of thousands of people will have more money to spend, and they will spend it, stimulating their local economy and spurring small business growth. In closing, I'd just like to point out that our state has raised its minimum wage three times from 1988 forward to 2012. And on two occasions, it was done in a three-step process. And despite desperate claims at the time by opponents that the sky was falling and that jobs were at risk, instead, small business grew tremendously during this period. U.S. business census data shows that following the over 40% increase in the minimum wage, which started in 1988 and took effect through 1991, small business grew in both the number of businesses and the number of jobs over the course of the next 10 years. Colleagues, I look forward to continuing to work with you on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much for getting us started on this informational meeting, and noting that you have sponsored, both of you signed on to sponsoring bills on the minimum wage, and as you know, we will be having public hearings on a smattering of those bills tonight, and with the Senate joining us in a joint public hearing. So thanks again, and we'll go ahead and call up some more panels to discuss more about minimum wage in Oregon. So with that, up next, I have Tom Chamberlain. Oh, no, I don't have Tom Chamberlain yet. John Oberst and Scott Winkles, you want to come up with him? Good morning, gentlemen. If you would introduce yourself before your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is John Oberst. I'm the mayor of Monmouth, Oregon.
Chair Holvey, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles. I represent the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities is an association that comprises all 242 incorporated cities in the state of Oregon, and all 242 of those cities operate under what we call home rule charters. I'll give before turning it over to Mr. Oberf, I'll give a brief primer on home rule in this state and explain why we are supportive of House Bill 2010, which would lift the preemption on minimum wage. Home rule, cities in Oregon don't derive their authority from the legislature. Cities derive that authority from the Constitution. The people of Oregon, well over 100 years ago, passed a home rule amendment to the Constitution. And I think they did so because what they wanted to see were local government officials, the level of government that's closest to them, legislating on issues that affect them in their daily lives. I think that was true when that was passed close to the turn of the last century, and I think that's true today. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mayor Oberst from the city of Monmouth to pontificate on this a little more.
Thank you.
And I was remiss in introducing myself to not mention I'm also a member of the board of the league, so I'm wearing two hats today. I think the comment I'd like to make about preemption is simply that one size does not fit all. We look around the state, and we have communities from Lake Oswego to Monmouth to Eugene to Lakeview, and each one of those communities faces different challenges. There are different conditions on the ground in those communities. We know housing, transportation costs, and sometimes even food costs can vary around the state. And what a minimum wage that might result in a fine standard of living in Monmouth could be poverty level 20 miles down the road in Corvallis. I can say that at one point we had housing under construction in Monmouth that was built by the same builder as in Corvallis, and it cost, this was 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it cost over $25,000 more for the same house in Corvallis than it did in Monmouth. So we see that those living costs vary around the state. Sometimes statewide policies make really good sense. Requiring an audit of every city every year is one of those, I think. Ethics rules would be another. The list goes on and on. I believe that setting the minimum wage in a community should be the responsibility of those closest to that community, and that's local government. And so I would ask that you pursue this bill and removing the preemption on local government's authority to set a different minimum wage, a higher minimum wage, than what has been set by the state. And with
Thank
that,
you. Representative Kinnemer, question?
Did you guys do a vote on this issue, and what was the outcome of that vote?
Chair Holby, Representative Kinnemer, no, the League didn't take a poll. The League has a standing policy and part of our charter and our historical position on lifting preemptions. We stand for local control.
I understand that. I also suspect there is a variety of opinion.
So curious, as I think about the state and potentially having different localities being able to have different minimum wage standards, it occurred to me that we actually have a system like that for prevailing wages, where the BOLI does surveys and determines the prevailing wage in different counties and regions around the state. Do you see, if we were to lift the preemption on minimum wage, that there would be a similar type of approach to surveying and establishing different minimum wages around the state depending on their location?
Chair Holby, what I would envision happening would be is that no city council would take this lightly or proceed rashly. Mm-hmm. I think there would be due diligence, a democratic ordinance process that involves input from both from their chambers of commerce and their business communities. I also think this notion of a patchwork system, I think this is a surmountable obstacle. What we've seen in the past, so when cities have preceded the state in providing worker protections, those have proceeded with very little complication. I don't know why this would be different.
So specifically, you're assuming that, I guess from what I'm hearing, that it would just merely be a vote of the local government as to what that wage would be instead of a system of surveying local areas.
Do you want to?
Now, Chair Holvey and committee, I would suggest that probably on fiscal matters of this level of import, city government that didn't ask for voter input would very rapidly be faced with a referral of such a measure. We see that in particularly in smaller towns like mine, where the signature gathering is not as high a number, same percentage, different numbers. City councils tend to defer to their populace on this, and I think you would see that it would take a city council taking a really deep look at the issue before they were willing to raise the minimum wage past a state standard, given sufficient information. I could see councils being willing to take that action, but I don't think they would just willy-nilly raise minimum wages.
And as we have, as you're speaking, a home rule charter, we also have counties that have home rule charters. So how would you broach that potential conflict if you had a county doing a minimum wage as well as a city within that county doing a minimum wage? Who wins?
Chair Holby, there are nine counties in Oregon who operate under home rule charters. Please don't ask me to name them, but I know there are nine.
Lane
is one of them. Outside of those nine counties, then the city would prevail that county would not be viewed as a superior government to the city. In those other nines, I don't know that question's been answered by the courts yet. I don't know that. I think we've gone to great lengths to avoid that. So some additional work to ensure that the city's decision on this matter would hold sway over the county may be necessary, because I think you open up a fairly significant can of worms when we start looking at city ordinances when it comes to a variety of issues where they may be at odds with their county.
Fair enough. I appreciate you starting it. Another question? Representative Evans.
Not a question, Chair. I just want to thank the mayor of Monmouth for coming in. It's good to see you here. And always nice to hear from the locals.
And Representative Evans, I still have a hard time not just calling you mayor. So.
We call him mayor. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Okay, now let's call up Tom Chamberlain. Cassell Capriel. I don't know if I said that correctly. And Aaron Zagatis. Good Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't know who would like to go first, but introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Holvey's, Vice Chairs Kennemer and Barton. My name's Tom Chamberlain, and I am the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, a statewide federation of labor unions and an advocate for all workers. When we represent over 300,000 working Oregonians and are proud to be on the front lines of a fight for an economy that works for all. And we believe that raising the minimum wage is an important component of that effort. The coalition of working to raise a minimum wage believe that no full-time worker should live in poverty. And fortunately, in our state, with the nation's second highest minimum wage, a full-time minimum wage worker falls below the poverty line. A family of three just makes $19,000 a year. Workers, business owners, organizational leaders, and advocates are here today because of two very different economic realities that Oregonians face today. Some say that the economic recovery of the 2008 Great Recession is well on its way, with some indicators suggesting that our economy is actually doing well. But looking at the state GDP and job creation numbers alone, this would be an accurate assessment. However, if you look a little closer at who's getting ahead and who's being left behind by this economy, you see a very different picture. While job creation numbers in isolation do look promising, the types of jobs we are creating in this state that lead to the positive numbers look very different than the jobs we lost during the Great Recession. Currently, almost 25% of our state's workers earn less than $12 an hour. Rather than high wage and middle class job growth, today's economic recovery in Oregon is relying on low wage, no benefit industry growth, largely in service and retail sectors. Additionally, at the same time, workers are facing more and more challenges just getting by and providing for their families. The state of Oregon has one of the highest percentage of workers receiving public assistance. What does this mean? It means that the state of Oregon is essentially subsidizing many large corporations by providing public assistance benefits to their workers when the employer refuses to provide adequate wages and these important benefits. Our state needs to do something. It needs to do everything in its power to rebuild a thriving middle class and move towards an economic recovery that is truly felt by all working Americans. While giving low-wage workers a significant raise won't fix these economic disparities alone, it is an incredibly important component of an agenda that this legislature can act upon that will make a difference in the lives of workers in all corners of the state. Opponents to raising the minimum wage will say that an increase will hurt small businesses across the state. While the needs of small businesses are important to consider, there are many that will say that the data suggests that putting more money in the pockets of Oregon minimum wage workers will boost spending, stimulating the state's economy, and actually helping small business by giving consumers more spending power. Another argument against raising the minimum wage is that significant raises will actually not have much of an impact on the lives of low-wage workers because many will be bumped from public assistance programs. The benefit cliff is an important reality, and we need to be very thoughtful about it. But keep in mind that over 200,000 Oregon workers in low-wage jobs do not receive any public assistance. And we see a direct raise with the minimum wage. Additionally, the legislature has the ability to change eligibility criteria and add funding so that families can earn a higher income and still get the support they need for their families. The coalition that has come together to raise Oregon's minimum wage consists of many voices representing small businesses, low-wage workers that will directly be impacted by this increase, the faith community, worker advocates, and community organizations, just to name a few. You'll hear from many of these voices this morning and throughout today's hearing. and we appreciate the opportunity to share with you the breadth and depth of this coalition, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and committee members. My name is Erin Zagatis. I'm a single mother and a full-time worker at a floral shop in Eugene. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about this important issue. I graduated from the University of Oregon with a bachelor's degree in 2003, and a couple years later I began working in the floral industry. And over the last 10 years, I've worked my way up and now manage a floral shop. I have all the responsibilities typical of a manager, including hiring, ordering, maintaining inventory levels, scheduling, meeting sales goals. I'm very good at my job. My floral designs have graced events at the University of Oregon, U of O athletics, the Holt Center political events, press conferences, and countless weddings. However, even though I have all these years of experience and I'm a manager with quite a bit of responsibility, I'm still only paid $12 an hour. I was paid more in my college job than I get paid now. I'm a single mother, raising a child not yet in school. And childcare is so expensive. I often feel that some days I am just working to pay the babysitter. Even though I have a steady job, financial insecurity is something I live with constantly. $12 an hour is simply not enough to cover the basics when you have a child. Rent, food, childcare, clothing, transportation, medical expenses. These costs keep going up, but wages do not. Any unexpected bill can throw my budget into a tailspin. Like any parent, I have dreams for my child. I want to be able to offer her opportunities. I want her to go to college. Right now, I'm not sure how I will be able to provide that sort of financial support for her. So many people like me work hard year after year, but still not making enough money to support their families. A raise in the minimum wage could go a long way towards alleviating the fear that families like us feel on a daily basis. I urge you to do what is right for the people of Oregon and raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, a level that is actually a living wage. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's my honor to be here sharing my story. My name is Cassiel Caprio. I moved from the United States of Micronesia to America 8 years ago in search of a better life. When I arrived in Portland, I dreamed of finding a job, settling down, and providing my children with a good education. I was able to get a job at the Portland International Airport, where I still work as a passenger service agent. My job at the PDX involved helping passengers in wheelchairs get around the airport, wherever folks need to go. When I started my job at the airport, the pay was minimum wage. After 8 years, I am still working for minimum wage. Now it's $9.25 an hour. Every day, I give all my effort at my job, but there is no path toward getting a raise or any type of benefits. Even with all of the effort that I put into my job, I still struggle. I'm a single mother, and it is difficult to balance the needs of my children with a full-time job. Because I am Micronesian, I cannot access public. I cannot access public health insurance in the United States, even though I have been here working for the same company for 8 years. But the insurance my employer provides is too expensive for me. In the last 2 years, my rent has gone up 3 times. Last month, it went up $500. Every month, I have to pay $75 extra to my landlord so I can pay half of my rent each paycheck. I'm a single mom. I live near the airport with my children. I like our apartment, and I don't want to move, but I don't know how I'll be able to keep up with rent. At the end of last year, my hours were cut from 40 to 32. Now it's even harder to pay rent on time. If we raise the minimum wage, I will be able to take home more money each paycheck, money I couldn't use to pay my rent on time for my children's education. most importantly, I will feel like I was treated with respect for the work I do. When I came to the U.S., I didn't think it would be like this. Now I just hold on to the only job that I know. Now, I just work hard and try to show my value. The dreams I have had haven't worked out. I just work to survive. It would be better if we made a fair wage. Right now, the Oregon legislature is considering raising the state minimum wage. It's time they take action to support Oregon working families. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions of this panel? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, you have mentioned that Oregon has the highest number of people requiring assistance, and yet we have one of the highest minimum wages already in the country. Can you tell me how that works?
I can't. You're going to have to ask someone who's done the research on this.
Follow up.
Yeah, and then I'm wondering if that's the case, then if we raise minimum wage from where it is now, will that create any more jobs, or will it put us even in a deeper disparity as far as assistance?
Based upon some earlier testimony, what we saw from 1988 to 1991 was an increase in small business ownership. So I don't believe it'd be any different cycle than it was in that time period.
One more follow-up.
And I believe there's data from Oregon Center for Public Policy that'll bear that out.
Yeah. Minimum wages, as they've increased in the past, have been very small increments, and now we're talking about major increments.
I don't believe that's true. I believe we had a significant wage increase that was phased in over 3 years in 1988. I believe it was a 30% or 40% increase. So even at that, we saw growth in small business ownership.
Thank you. So, Aaron, I'm just curious about your workplace, where as a manager you make $12 an hour. How much are your fellow workers that work there make? What do they make?
I just hired somebody about 3 weeks ago. He makes minimum wage. My coworker, who's been there the longest, she makes, I think, $10.50 or $11. So I'm the highest paid at in my whole shop, but it's still $12 an hour.
Yeah. And how many people work there?
Yeah, there's two of us work full-time and two others who work part-time.
Okay.
And we have three locations, so there's other locations where people work, too.
Oh, so the same business has other locations with about the same amount of people?
Yeah, similar amounts. Yep.
All right. Really appreciate your testimony this morning and getting us started. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So up next, Bill Perry, Betsy Earls, and Jan Meekums.
Members of the committee, Chair Holvey, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. First of all, I kind of want to stress a little bit of the conversation that happened just at the previous panel. Is it seems like there's an issue of minimum wage, and everybody keeps trying to tie it to a solution to poverty, which when you look at Oregon, you know, we've tend to have the higher than average minimum wage. We tend to have a higher than average unemployment, and we have a higher than average poverty rate. So I don't know why these two keep getting connected. So if you want to have a conversation about minimum wage, I think we can have that. But if you want to have a thing about poverty, there's a bunch of things that play into poverty. And I would just say that is a solution. Minimum wage has shown that it's not a solution. So I just wish the two would be separated from a personal standpoint, because I think we can all agree that reducing the poverty rate should be the utmost important to all of us here in the legislative process. I don't like the fact that we keep connecting this. And actually, daycare, I think, is a great example of what kind of the I know Representative Nose went through some different sectors. So generally, minimum wage workers tend to shop or use people that hire minimum wage services. So generally, when you sit there and hear about raises in the minimum wage don't have impacts on the overall economy, I would argue that that could be true. But when you look at the negative impacts on a minimum wage worker, it's pretty dramatic. So last November or October, when this issue came up, I went to my daycare provider and I just said, will you do me a favor and run the numbers if minimum wage goes to $12? I gave him that number specifically. When I dropped off my little boy the next day, he just basically said, I've got two high school workers that come in after school. We'd probably eliminate those two positions, and then I'd probably raise my rates about 18%. Now, if you're just a single person with no kids and you do not lose your job or hours, then you could see a windfall. If you've got one child in daycare, you're probably not going to see a windfall. If you got two kids in daycare, you're probably going to lose. It's just, once again, if we specifically are trying to tie minimum wage as a solution, I just don't see how this is a solution to the issue. So what I wanted to do kind of today is, I think you're going to hear a lot of different things, but there's a specific hardship in our industry that's very specific to our industry that most of you have heard about, but some of you haven't. So, and I'll probably go through, and it's the issue of tip credit. Let's just throw it out there on the table. And so basically, our industry is the only industry where you can't use commissions towards offsetting minimum wage. You just can't. If you look at the back of your packet, I highlighted the statute, and if you look, it says basically say employers may include commissions as payments to employees as part of minimum wage. Well, in 1977, when you look at the second highlighted section, they basically took tips out of the definition of commissions. That's all they did. And so every other industry, car salesman, Nordstrom salesman, you pick it, you can offset any commissions you make as it relates to commissions or minimum wage. Now, if you go just a couple of pages back from there where you see page 16 and it says summary, this study was done back when minimum wage was at $6.50. And it's, when you look at question 27 at the top of the page, it says, how much are servers reporting as tips? And it's $5.60 an hour. So that's almost minimum wage. That's what they're reporting. Then you go down and says, what are you making in tips? Because I got to keep all the credit card receipts so I can tell them how much they're making, and it's $9.40. Now, earlier or in this packet also, and I made the statement last week, the way our industry works, you cannot have a server on the floor that doesn't make double the minimum wage. It's just not economically possible. And so I'd say if you get servers coming up here at this hearing that says they make $2 or $3 an hour, they're probably got a tip jar. You know, the ones at the counter at the front, which aren't classified as a tipped employee. But for me to have a server on the floor, I cannot, they have to make double the minimum wage. It's just not economically feasible for that to happen. So why that's important in our industry is usually people in the back of the house make, on average right now, somewhere between $12 and $15 an hour. Okay? If you raise the minimum wage to $12 and you basically don't let me freeze those for servers, I got to take half the employees in my restaurant that are making over $20 an hour and give them a $3 bump in the minimum wage. They would be coming up to where the cooks are. Okay? Now, if you look at that, how easy is it for me as a restaurant, once you've raised half the wages in my restaurant, to give those people making 12 or 15 a bump? It becomes very problematic. Now, if you look at the flip side, okay, if you freeze it for servers, okay, and you bump it up to 12, my $12 and $15 an hour employees are going to want to raise, okay? So when I do that, what happens to my menu prices? They go up, okay? What happens to the server's tips? They go up. That's the way commissioned offices are supposed to, or businesses are supposed to work. Let me raise the wages for everybody else in the establishment, and then the 15% becomes bigger or 18% comes bigger. I mean, if you want to first, you know, back to my point, separate it from poverty. Now, if you want to have a discussion about how do you raise the minimum wage and truly try to impact that single person making minimum wage that might have kids, you have to really start to dive into this, because every industry in this room is going to be impacted differently. This is one specific example for my establishments. And I would argue, when you look at the females or the people that are 25 to 35, they're probably servers, and they're making well over the minimum wage. Now, I don't want to take their tips away from them, which I can if I don't institute a tip credit, because the more they get rewarded for sales, the more my pool grows to pay more people. That's the way commissions work. So, I mean, there's negative impacts to a universal increase in the minimum wage. There's specific impacts in these individual industries that are done. So, I mean, if you want to have a real discussion of how do you raise the minimum wage without doing damage, there's ways to do it. But we really have to have an open, honest conversation with it instead of just pick a number and pick it, because I don't think it's going to help anybody and it's going to create a lot of problems. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, an association of about 7,000 privately owned small businesses throughout the state of Oregon. I would just like to make a few comments. I don't want to spend a lot of time this morning because there's a lot of data yet to be heard. But I would like to start out by saying there's numerous reports that have talked about the raising of minimum wage in relationship to the loss of jobs. NFIB has done several state-specific reports, not one for Oregon, but in Illinois in March of 2014, that they found that in raising the minimum wage from $9.25 to $10.65 would lose about 45,000 jobs in that state. Massachusetts in July of 2013, raising minimum wage to $11 in 2015 would lose about 62,000 jobs. New Jersey in 2013, raising the minimum wage above $8.25 would lose about 31,000 jobs. California in 2013 study, 68,000 jobs. New York in 2012, 22,000 jobs. And this is agreed to by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office when President Obama suggested a 10-10 minimum wage raise. They projected that that would lose about 500,000 jobs in the United States. Also, we had stated in earlier testimony that about small business growing and businesses opening after minimum wage was raised in Oregon. That is true, but there's something that we don't know. And those are the businesses that didn't grow, the businesses that did shut, and the businesses that never arrived in the first place because of minimum wage being what it is. There's also another problem with raising minimum wage, and that there's an article in March of 2014 entitled "The Shift from Low-Wage Worker to Robot Worker." And there's, in my written testimony, there's a link to the full article. And there's a quote from the article where it says, details are commonplace of computers replacing the American worker with a rise in minimum wage. Waitresses, fast food workers, and others earning at or near minimum wage should also be on alert. And that was stated by in the Oregon Business Plan in December. There was a seafood processor that said if we go to $15 an hour minimum wage, that he will be forced to automate, and that which he can produce in New Zealand, in Iceland, where this has been done with mechanizing the process, they can produce with three workers what it takes him 45 workers to produce. So that's a prime example of the effect of minimum wage. And lastly, I'd just like to say that minimum wage, the raising of minimum wage, we consider to be a small business issue. And the reason for that is big corporations do not have to absorb the cost of minimum wage increases to the extent that small business does, because most minimum wage jobs are offered by small businesses. Small businesses are the least able to absorb such a dramatic increase in their labor costs. And the small business sector has historically created two-thirds of net new private jobs in the U.S. economy, but it has been slower to recover from the recession in recent years because of a series of policies, such as higher taxes, increases to health care costs, more costly regulations, and now a proposal in increased minimum wage. The minimum wage directly affects small businesses because a large amount of their earnings go directly to pay for operating expenses such as equipment, supplies, lease or mortgage, credit lines, inventory, and employee wages and benefits. These proposals do not incentivize growth or hiring. They make it nearly impossible. So for these reasons, and there's a great deal of studies that I have referenced in my written testimony with links to those studies that all will support the fact that increasing minimum wage will cost jobs and ultimately hurts the lower wage worker, the very workers that minimum wage is attempting to help. And with that, I'm open to questions.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. And before I start, I had handed out the business community's job killer list, which I think all of you have seen before. I included again with your packets only because it has the minimum wage bills on it. And attached to the back is a little bit deeper piece that we put together prior to session with some more of the business community's perspective on better approaches than a minimum wage increase. So I know you've seen that before, but we thought it was worth seeing again. So thanks for the opportunity to testify before you on the minimum wage increase bills that are before this legislature. To the business community, the minimum wage debate is really about more than whether the legislature is going to require employers to pay their low-wage and entry-level workers a few dollars more an hour. We see this conversation as an opportunity for the legislature to consider, in a broader sense, which paths you want to provide for Oregonians to flourish. Do you really want to provide businesses? Do you really want to require businesses to pay more? Or do you want businesses to increase pay because economic conditions demand it? Many of the bills we've seen this session that mandate certain terms and conditions of employment are responses to Oregon's recent economic crisis. Of course, the economy faltered, and when that happens, businesses will always do the best they can to stay afloat. Unfortunately, sometimes that's going to mean cutting labor costs, either by laying people off or by restricting benefits and pay. And I think some of the bills that we've seen recently are in response to, you know, some of those natural reactions to a faltering economy. But it looks like Oregon's economy is starting to recover. And I would suggest that a better long-term strategy for taking advantage of that fact is that you seek policy opportunities that will help grow the economy, causing workers to be paid more because employers have to pay them more in order to get workers, not simply because they're required to do so by law. It hasn't been that long since the economy in Oregon was very strong. And I remember one summer, you know, not that long ago, driving up to a gas station and seeing painted in the window, hiring, 401k benefits provided. I think that's what we're shooting for here is businesses that are competing for workers in a very strong economy. So that said, I wanted to take just a minute to talk with you about the impact that an increased minimum wage would have on manufacturers, because I think that's a conversation that's sometimes lost in this. Oregon's economy, as you know, is really heavily supported by manufacturing, and particularly in high tech and the components of high tech. But these manufacturers face very stiff competition from their overseas counterparts, both inside and outside their companies. One of our manufacturing members mentioned last week that some of the stiffest competition they face is actually from their parent company's other plants around the globe. That's tough because the Oregon plant competes for business with their sister facility in Singapore. And frankly, Singapore's payroll costs are about one-third of Oregon's. We're not talking or suggesting that we cut our payroll costs in Oregon or anything like that, but you need to consider the fact that Oregon jobs are competing around the globe with countries that have lower payroll costs and will be more competitive. If the Oregon plant that I'm referring to becomes less competitive, the owners are simply going to move those jobs to other parts of the world. And I don't think that's something that any of us want to see. I have two particular points about minimum wage workers in manufacturing. One is that they're typically entry-level workers, and their pay increases with experience. The other is they're frequently provided with benefit packages that significantly increase their overall compensation. And those benefits are generally benefits that are not taxable, whereas a wage or increased wage is taxable. So the fact that those entry-level employees' wages increase with experience is important because it means that a mandated minimum wage increase is going to cause wage compression within that company, where an employer who's worked for several years at their job, going from, say, $9.25 or $10 or whatever to $16 an hour, is not going to be happy to see new employees starting close to his or her current pay. That's not, a cost that you can quantify particularly, but it will be a problem in those companies. The other point I wanted to make is that the fact that entry-level and low-wage employees have those benefit packages means that to stay competitive, manufacturers in the situation that I mentioned earlier are going to have to shift labor costs by decreasing benefits. And the tax implications for an employee in this scenario really are not great. Wages, as I pointed out, are taxed as income, whereas benefits like 401k matches or health coverage are not. It's not something employers are doing to be mean or to, find retribution or, anything like that. It's just the simple fact that they have to remain competitive with companies all around the world that are competing for the same business. So instead of simply mandating that employers pay more, I would really encourage you this session, and as you look at the minimum wage bills before you, to support policies that strengthen the economy and really put workers in a better position to earn higher wages based on their own improved education and skills. That's what I got.
Representative Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if anyone on the panel could tell me what they think that workers who garner an additional $10,000 a year in income would do with that money.
Oh. Chair Holvey, Representative Nose. This is not from our perspective, this is not just a simple economic equation. I mean, you don't just all of a sudden say $15 an hour and there's going to be no change in what's going to, every restaurant's going to handle it differently. Every business at this table is going to handle it differently. If you can pass on the cost, you'll do it. But if that is true, then it goes back to my daycare example. If the price of food goes up by 6 to 9%, daycare by 18%, all that kind of stuff, they're going to be spending that $10,000 the same way they spend it today. Now, that's if it's just a straight pass-through. If you're just raising all the costs on all the businesses that sell the minimum wage workers, it's just a straight pass-through. But everybody's going to handle it differently. Some guys are going to reduce hours and do a slight increase in costs. There's all these different aspects that are going to happen in every individual business based. And so, if you give somebody more money, they're going to spend it, but they're also going to be spending it. They're going to spend more on daycare. They're going to be spending more on food. There's nothing that shows that they're actually getting more for the dollars. That's the thing that nobody has any proof. And remember, when you look at it in macro, when they say small business starts go up, well, a high-tech small business start doesn't have anything to do with minimum wage workers. They don't hire them. They don't service them. And, so you might see business starts go up, but you really need to delve down is what is happening in the segment that hires and services minimum wage workers. And I don't think you'll see anybody, they could lose hours or spend more on the goods and services they're buying. So,
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I guess I would just point out to the panel that studies that we've seen show that the sector where jobs are growing are the service sector. And if we raise those people's wages, people who work in those sectors, they're going to spend their new financial resources in your businesses. They're going to go out to eat. They're going to buy flowers. They're going to fix up their cars. And I respectfully disagree. I think studies show that the economy is driven by demand. And when you put dollars in the hands of people, they will spend it. And they will spend it in your businesses.
Representative Doherty.
Okay, I have two questions of Mr. Perry and one of Ms. Meekum. On the labor cost on the tipped establishments and the chart that you have, when I worked in hospitality, I worked the front of the house and had to split my tips with the back of the house. Mm-hmm. Does this indicate where you've got, like, for example, on a $20 sale, you get a $3.10 tip? Is that the tip to the waitress and wait person, or is it also split with the back of the house?
Chairman Holby, Representative Doherty, and I don't want to do a disservice to the attorneys on the panel, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, or they can correct the way I present it. So there's been a couple of court cases. First one is Kumbi versus Woody Woo, which was about 5 or 6 years ago. Department of Labor is not allowing us to do, by law, is not allowing us to do tip pooling, which is what I think you're referring to. Now, does it happen? Yes, it happens. I always have my members call me up and ask me if they can do this, and I say no, and they say, well, I know other places that do it. And I said, well, you didn't ask me if it was common. They asked me if it's legal. So two different questions. But the appeals court actually handed out and said, no, Department of Labor, the way the law reads in Fair Labor Standards Act is it says all the tip pooling restrictions fall under the tip credit section of law. So what that means is once you utilize a tip credit, the tips are protected. If you don't utilize a tip credit, then tips aren't protected. Does that make sense?
Well, no, that was not my question. My question is of the example you use here, are they splitting it with the back of the house?
They're not. Legally, they're not supposed
okay.
to.
Okay. In your business, do they split it with the back of the house?
As of right now, it's in the appeals court. It's going up under Oregon Restaurant Lodging versus DOL. But remember, as far as is what we're saying with a tip credit is you would lose that right. So as of right now, I don't think they are. They will be, I think, because the appeals court is going to agree with us.
Well, I'm saying they do split them with the back of the house, and that's most restaurants. So
not
so,
most.
So what I'm going to say, what my point was, is so if you go through and say a wait person is getting 15% to 20% on a $50 or $60 bill, that is not the case because they're taking part of those tips and they're being split. So I just wanted to make that point clear.
Well, and I would say that on independents it is a lot higher. Usually on chain restaurants, because of the legal ramifications, they don't.
Yeah, I just wanted to point that out. And the second thing is you also go through and compare commissions on the back part of the statute, mm-hmm. and are kind of talking about it with the tips. What is your experience when it comes to splitting commissions? And the reason is I worked also in retail where we did get commissions, and it was not odd if I would go through even back in the olden days and sell $400 worth of clothing, you know, at one fell swoop, and the commission was pretty good. Mm-hmm. And so I just wondered with the comparison of commissions at places like Car Sales and Nordstrom's and other places versus tips, whether that was a fair comparison. I know you're comparing that in the law you can take, you know, commissions and you can back those out of the wage. But it was like apples to oranges. The commissions many times are very, very high.
Yeah.
So you're making way over minimum wage.
Yeah, and Representative Chair Holby and Representative Doherty, but also under the Fair Labor Standards Act, our industry is the only one that requires you to pay a base wage on top of it. The other ones, you can take it all the way down to zero.
Okay. And then the question I have for Ms. Meekum is a lot of people have talked about it, you know, that, you know, with the minimum wage. Do you have any information on how many of your businesses pay minimum wage versus how many of your members don't pay a higher minimum wage? And because we keep hearing this, I think kind of the idea and the impression that's coming out is everyone pays minimum wage, and I don't think that's the case. So do you have any idea as to what the percentage is?
I don't. I haven't seen it statistically, but it may be available, and I can go to my research department and see if they have that data for you and get
Thank
back
you.
With you on it.
Yeah, I
But I would
that.
Agree with your assumption. Because a lot of the members I do talk to about, they'll say, we disagree, or they'll have an opinion on mm-hmm. raising minimum wage, and they will say, we already pay over minimum wage, but. So I would say, yes, a great deal do pay above minimum
okay,
wage.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, I think, Ms. Earls, your assistant left something on the chair back there for you. There was a chart that I saw partly earlier, and I'd love to have you share it with the. But the question that I have for the panel is, you know, we've been hearing a lot about, I guess in the old days we called it trickle-down economy, and that if we put this money into the economy, that it will trickle down. And I guess we had a recent experience of that in just north of us in Seattle. And I wonder if you have some information about that.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee and Representative Kennemer, I did get an article recently that I didn't use in my testimony that I can pull out, and it does report some adverse effects of, I think, businesses closing, particularly restaurants, in the Seattle area as a result, and some that decided not to open that were going to in the Seattle area as a result of that. So I can get you that data and send it and share it with the committee. One thing I would like to say regarding the minimum wage and the different responses from the testimonies, written testimonies that my members have given me, the different kinds of responses. One is for Salem Kaiser Business that does a 24-hour answering service. I can't remember the statistics. I think they provide something like 1,000 business hours a week. And what the increased minimum wage would mean to them, and it was like over $100,000 a year that they would have, that it would cost them more. And most of their employees are high school and college entry, part-time, because it works with their education, although they do have some employees that have been with them for over 20 years, and they also do profit sharing. And what he said he would have to do, he would have to raise his prices, he felt, at least 10%, and for an answering service, there's a point where it will cause his customers to go to an automated answering service, thereby losing customers, and that the first place they would look to cut would be benefits, and their at what level, who they could cut out of their workforce. I think that's a pretty typical response that we have heard. And another choice, this business has been in business for 62 years, and they're saying another choice, I think there's a point where we would have to look at actually closing our doors, and all of those people would lose their job. So that's part of the equation of the low worker impact. Yes, some may make more money, and their net may be more that then would go back into the economy. But there are those that their net would not be more. It could actually be less. But what we're not talking about are those workers that do not get hired because there's been a freeze at that level, or those workers that lose their job. For those workers, the loss is substantial. And I think that needs to be considered as part of the equation.
Mr. Chair. I wonder if Ms. Searles could respond
sure.
to this graph, please.
Oh, sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I did have handed out to you this chart that you'll see that looks a little bit different than what Representative Kennemer was looking at, I think. But it shows states that have very high food insecurity and compared to the minimum wages that they have. And I think the point that I would make with this is that there's not a direct correlation or very much correlation at all between a state's minimum wage and the level of food security or insecurity of citizens, or a particular correlation between median household income.
Representative Evans.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. Three questions, and really more toward the larger conversation. I really do respect what you're saying as far as if you want to talk about poverty and economics, that's a longer discussion than a particular bill about a particular wage. However, since we talked about Singapore, there are some things about Singapore I'm not certain you really want to compare.
No.
The taxes, the universal health care access, and the way in which the 8 million workers that are there are there for a year and then have to leave. Not sure Singapore is really where we want to necessarily say is the best place for Oregon companies to be having manufacturing. But having said that, one of the things that is frustrating is that really I think that there are two kinds of companies, the companies that have a really long-term investment in the state of Oregon, and we as a group, I think, regardless of party, want to help them grow, prosper, and develop workers. And then there are some that have global responsibilities and because of the U.S. tax code still benefit as U.S. companies, even if most of their commerce is now no longer in the United States. Kellogg Brown and Root, for example, still getting American contracts for bases, even though most of their stuff is now in the Middle East. So my question is this. Whatever happens with this particular series of bills on the minimum wage, there are many of us that would like to have that greater conversation about how we actually build incentives for manufacturing to be developed and want to stay here, regardless of the global dynamics. Because the fundamental truth that we have all been skirting because we've been trying to make do with what we can is that once mobility of capital became as easy as a toggle switch or a click on a mouse, free market theories that we based our economy on ceased to exist. David Ricardo was very clear about what would happen when mobility of capital became so clear that you could move it around, and we need to find a new model. So my question is this. Will the three of you and the folks that you work with commit to helping us after the session try to come up with some strategies for long-term manufacturing sustainability?
Mr. Chair, if I could start, I should have clarified the company that I, you're right, first of all, there's a lot I don't know about Singapore. But the company I reference is not an Oregon company. It's a German company, and it has a plant in Oregon because Oregon has a great workforce. They also have a plant in Singapore. So there's not a lot I can say about that other than Singapore apparently is a cheaper place to do business.
$200,000 to buy a car in Singapore.
Well, there's that.
it's also an island.
But in answer to your question, we would absolutely commit to working with you on ways to bring more manufacturing to Oregon. And there are, in fact, several bills in the legislature right now that I think have been well received by this committee that would help do the same thing.
Okay.
Chair Holvey, Representative Evans. I mean, all along on minimum wage and any of these other things, obviously you know the issues that are important to our members, so you can decide at that point whether or not you want me involved. But we've tend to, you know, a lot of these issues we can tend to compromise. And back to the kind of the other sets of bills, you know, too long in this process, I think people have, when they've been asked to compromise interest groups, they decide I'm either going to go to the local level or the ballot. And it's just frustrating because I do think when you look at all across this board, curing poverty, I don't think there's anybody on this committee that doesn't want to solve it. I mean, but it's going to take compromise. And if, as long as things are able to be kicked to the ballot or kicked to the local governments, then you're tend not to going to have compromise. And we all truly have to come to the table and say, what's the goal? If it's trying to, you know, single parents, you know, I think there's ways to get there that most of us can agree on. But, you know, as long as we have local governments and ballot measures, I'm not really optimistic because it seems like that's driving the conversation instead of solving it from my vantage point. But I'm happy to help.
Representative Barreto, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I wanted to, after asking Tom Chamberlain about the increase in minimum wage, I did look it up, and actually back in 79 and 80, we did have a 60-cent a year increase back then, but then from 80 to 88, we had a 3% increase a year, or 3-cent increase a year. The highest beyond that is 45 cents a year that we've had for a minimum wage increase. And then to go to Representative Nosa's comment about will this money go back into the economy, that's true. It would. Someone has to pay for that. But if that's the case, then why not go to $25 an hour minimum wage, you know, to really get the economy going? The other thing I'd like to ask maybe Jan, if she knows, is for every displaced worker, how many more workers does it take to pay for their assistance when they're unemployed?
That is a really good, Chair Holvey and members of the committee and Representative Barreto, that's an excellent question that I do not have the answer to. Again, I can do some research and see if I have access to that answer.
Thank you.
Representative Nose, one last question for this panel.
It's just that I would ask that Jan Meekums make sure that her report gets on all of us, because I'd like to look at those reports. I think we do a lot of legislating around here around antidote, and so looking at reports and data, I would happily be interested in reading that. And I would just like to point out one thing about something that happened with regard to Washington and raising their minimum wage. There was a release by the Washington Policy Center stated that the minimum wage increase in Seattle was killing restaurants. Well, that was proven patently false by both the Seattle Times and Forbes magazine. And I'll make sure that that gets on all this so that members of this committee can see it. The Institute put out a press release based on an article about four restaurants closing. But when the Seattle Times went out and interviewed those restaurants, they all said that the minimum wage had nothing to do with their closure. So I'll make sure that that's on all this so that people can see it. I think that's important because there's a lot of anecdote around this that I don't think really bears out, which is why I'll be interested to see the studies that Ms. Meekham talked about, and others have studies as well.
Thank you.
May I respond to that?
Sure.
Thank you. It was regarding the Seattle closing. That was actually an article in the Seattle paper that I was referring to. The other studies that I refer to are on my written testimony with links to every study, including the multiple state studies. So there, it should be on all us right now.
Right on.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony this morning. Up next, Stephen Michael, Justin Norton Kirsten, and Daniel Morris. Good morning. You'd introduce yourself for the record, whoever is going first.
Good morning, Representative Holvey, Chair Holvey, excuse me, and members of the committee. My name is Stephen Michael. I'm the state director and the campaigns manager for the Main Street Alliance of Oregon. We are a coalition of over 2,500 small businesses from across the state who really work to bring the small business voice forward on key public policy issues, and this is definitely one that we see as a key public policy issue. My written testimony is going around right now as well. I will quickly like to reference, note a couple of points based on the testimony just heard. One, those four restaurants that were noted in that article, two of them actually are opening new restaurants and closing a couple of restaurants that weren't going well, but opening new ones. So even with the increase, we are seeing an increase of small businesses. But we will say so. The Main Street Alliance of Oregon is in full favor of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour for a lot of the economic benefits, a lot of the economic reasons that you've heard so far this morning, the influx of money, the influx of the $3.2 billion into the economy. But primarily, small business owners know that an investment in their employees is the best investment they can make into their business. Small business owners that we work with, their businesses wouldn't run if it weren't for their employees. If it weren't for the folks that are keeping their customers coming back, the ones that are manning the cash registers, the ones that are selling their produce, the ones that are in their stores every day, in and out. Unless the small business owner themselves, who's already wearing 20 different hats, wants to also do everything else in the shop, they need employees. And this is a competitive market, and we want to make sure that that small businesses continue to succeed. And one of the ways that happens is with direct community investment, community involvement. And we know that the people that are earning the least are spending the most of their paychecks in local economies. And so if we raise the wages at the bottom, that's a direct impact, a direct positive impact on the small business's bottom line. Additionally, throughout our research, our work, our outreach across the state, our organizers ask small business owners in the field a series of questions. We've got a policy survey we put out, and I've shared the results of that survey with you previously. But one of the big questions that we ask to kind of get the conversation going is, as a small business owner, what do you need most to create more jobs and get the economy back on track? Is it lower taxes, fewer regulations, more customers, or anything else? And most of the people that we talk to, in fact, 68%, say more customers. And more customers means people having more money in their pockets to spend. And so this is a pretty obvious thing for the most of the part that we work with. And recently, we've also been asking a number of questions about the minimum wage and what an impact would look like on an increased minimum wage on small business owners that we're working with. And a number of these business owners will actually be testifying later this evening, public testimony. But I will say that over 90% of the folks we talked to agreed with the fact that Oregonians working full-time should not be living in poverty. And we know, based on the economic research, the evidence, that Oregonians working full-time are earning the minimum wage are living in poverty, below the federal poverty line. And that's just unacceptable. And in addition, 67% of the people that we talked to would support a raise of the minimum wage. So with over two-thirds of small business owners that we're working with across the state thinking that that raising the minimum wage is a good idea, it kind of leads to the question as to why. I mean, if business owners are the ones that are going to be spending more on their employees, why would they think this is a good thing to do? And it's simple, because they are working families themselves. Small business owners are going to their shops day in and day out, too. They don't look at employees like a line item on their budget. Their employees are sometimes a part of their family. Their employees are a part of a team, and everyone's accountable to each other. And if you're respecting your employees more, if you're paying them a living wage, if you're making sure that they can afford to pay their rent, afford to pay their child care, afford to keep putting food on the table, and have a little bit of money left over to set aside to make sure that you have some savings, then that's something that we can all get behind. And I will say, too, that that Mr. Perry said that raising the minimum wage itself isn't a solution to poverty. I completely agree. And this is a larger conversation. We need to have access to basic workplace standards. People need to make sure that they can afford to take a day off of work to take care of a family member. People need to make sure that they have opportunities to save for retirement. People need to make sure that they have equal opportunities in the workplace, regardless of their backgrounds. This is a larger conversation, and I'm happy that we're having the conversation, but the minimum wage increase is one piece of the puzzle that needs to get solved. And I urge you, along with a lot of our members that you'll hear from later tonight, that this is a really important step for Oregon to take and for you to take the lead. And I will just close with saying that this is a good thing for business. Lots of times we're talking about how raising the wage won't hurt business that much, but no, this is an economic benefit for small businesses, especially considering that 62% of the jobs that are paying under $15 an hour right now are in businesses that have more than 50 employees, and 52%. Overall are 100 and more employees. And so these are huge businesses that are employing most of these low-wage workers. And so most of the economic, the payout impact is going to be seen by these big businesses, and the benefit is going to be seen by the small businesses. So if you want to do something to help small businesses in Oregon, raise the minimum wage to $15.
Representative Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Justin Norton Kurtzen. I'm a representative of 15 Now Oregon. Oregon's economy has grown at 3 times the national rate, but the recovery has hardly been felt by working people because wages have been stagnant for decades and have not kept pace with the cost of living. You have an opportunity to change that by taking a strong stand for Oregon's working families and passing a $15 minimum wage. Studies from the University of Washington, the Alliance for a Just Society, the National Low Income Housing Coalition, all place a living wage for the state of Oregon at above $15 per hour. So it's not just that 15 is a nationwide movement that's inspiring workers across the country. Rather, it's that $15 is actually the right number for Oregon. Right now, some 600,000 working Oregonians earn poverty wages. Some 200,000 of them make so little that they're still eligible for public benefits. And Oregon taxpayers are on the hook for over $1.7 billion per year to subsidize the poverty wages of the large, wealthy corporations that are paying these low wages. But raising the minimum wage to $15 per hour, it's not just a benefit for workers, but for businesses as well. You know, it's really easy to tout studies of hypothetical minimum wage increases and the hypothetical jobs that might be lost. But when we look at real studies of real minimum wage increases that have happened across the country, here in Oregon and elsewhere, we see that these job losses just don't take place. The minimum wage raise in the late 80s, early 90s here in Oregon is a good example, as is San Jose, California in 2013. They raised their minimum wage by $2 per hour all at once. Over the course of the next year, the restaurant industry created 4,000 new jobs within the city, and small retail business registrations went up by 19% over the course of the next year. A $15 minimum wage will inject some $3 billion of new spending into our economy. That will be good for Oregon. Too many good-paying jobs has never been a problem for any economy, anywhere. That's why anything less than 15 isn't enough. It isn't enough for Ian, a college graduate living in Eugene and working at a call center earning poverty wages. It isn't enough for Janice, who drives a school bus in Portland but still struggles to pay her bills. It's time for working people in Oregon to get their fair share of the wealth and the strong economy that they've helped create. We can ensure that no one who works lives in poverty, or we can keep wasting tax dollars to subsidize the poverty wages of wealthy corporations. Now think about that. No one who works should live in poverty. This basic moral value is why over 100 labor unions, faith organizations, and community organizations in Oregon have joined the fight for 15. It's why we've engaged hundreds of volunteers all over the state, and why thousands of Oregonians across the state have signed petitions in support of a $15 minimum wage. They're ready to act. This Wednesday, rallies and marches will take place across the state. Worksite actions will take place across the state for a $15 minimum wage as part of a national day of action. The working people of Oregon have been activated, and we demand a $15 minimum wage. No one who works should live in poverty. You have the opportunity to make this basic moral value a reality here in Oregon. $15 is the right number, and 15 now will not compromise on this because anything less is not enough. Because this is about what is right for working people, not about what deal can be struck with big business. We call on this committee and the state legislature, and we demand that Oregon's minimum wage be raised to $15 per hour. If you fail to act, this movement will still win. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Daniel Morris. I'm the research director for Our Oregon. I'm happy to be here today testifying in support of raising Oregon's minimum wage. Doing so would help out hundreds of thousands of working families in Oregon, as well as provide a much-needed boost to our economy. I've submitted written remarks with have a lot of this information in more detail. I think we've already heard a lot of statistics today, so I'll try not to just repeat everything that's already been said. I do just want to stress again that our economy is really not working for most Oregonians. Even though corporate profits are up and the in income, we are seeing growth in some high wage jobs and the highest income earners have been seeing their incomes go up. For most Oregonians, they aren't sharing in that economic growth. I actually just read a new report from the state economists that that only 43% of the middle wage jobs that were lost during the recession have come back since then. And most of the job growth in the metro areas, especially in Portland, we have seen a lot of high wage job growth. But in most of the rest of the state, really the only new jobs are low wage jobs. And many of these are only part-time or temporary. In 2014, actually three-quarters of all the job vacancies in Oregon paid less than $15 an hour, according to the Oregon Employment Department. So we're really talking about many people who really desperately need a raise. We've heard already today, nearly 600,000 Oregonians currently work for less than $15 an hour, and all those workers would see their wages go up with a $15 minimum wage. Of minimum wage workers, low wage workers, about two-thirds are women around the country, and that holds true in Oregon as well. Many of these women are single moms trying to support family on their low wages. I think like as a result, and these numbers, I spend all day looking at numbers, but they still shock me to learn that that when you look at single mothers in Oregon who have young children, over half are living in poverty, and that's just I think it's a really sobering statistic, and it's sort of hard even to wrap my head around that in a time when there's so much. There is so much kind of economic growth and wealth that's being generated that so many Oregonians are really being left behind. I just like to echo some of the earlier comments that, for the most part, these low-wage jobs that we're seeing are not just entry-level jobs for teenagers. The vast majority of workers who are in low-wage occupations are adults, and I think the average age is around 35 years old. Nationally, almost 90%, 9 out of 10 low-wage workers are over the age of 20. And even in the industries that tend to employ the kind of the youngest workforce, the retail trade sector, and the and kind of the food service sector. When we look at data from the kind of state data on working adults who are receiving food assistance, even there, the sort of the median age is around 27, 28 for those workers. So most of them are actually older than their sort of late 20s. I heard a few things in some previous testimony that I was sort of frankly confused about, or I don't necessarily agree with. Mr. Perry was talking a bit about sort of tipped employees and trying to make this case. I found that honestly a bit confusing. We don't have a tipped minimum wage in Oregon. We don't have a tipped credit, to my knowledge. So I'm not really sure how that discussion is really sort of relevant to sort of what we're talking about today. In addition, that looking at the data on the SNAP recipients, there are more people who are receiving SNAP and working in fast food restaurants than are receiving SNAP and working in other sort of full service restaurants, and those fast food restaurant workers aren't getting tips. I think that there's a I think that maybe that whole discussion is kind of confusing and needs a little more attention. And then the other thing I just wanted to also sort of bring attention to is that there have been hundreds of studies looking at the impact of minimum wage increases around the country, and large increases and small increases and so forth. And I think it's sort of easy to sort of cherry pick just one out that sort of supports your position, but sort of as a scientist, what we like to be able to do is actually look at sort of the range of these studies and to try to actually produce sort of generalizable knowledge. And there have been a couple good sort of large-scale reviews of where they have looked at hundreds of these studies, specifically looking at the effects on employment. And what they conclude is that the effects on employment are really negligible. When you look sort of across the entire body of research relating to minimum wage increases, so really sort of based on the empirical evidence, I think these kind of the doom and gloom predictions about massive job losses are really unfounded, and they're just not consistent with what's been observed out in the kind of across the studies on the topic. So I think with that, I'd just like to conclude again that I really feel like Oregonians need a raise. I think the stakes are just too high for too many families, and too many people just can't wait any longer to see their wages go up. Oregonians support raising the minimum wage, and I know they'd be happy to see the legislature take action during the session. I urge you to support raising the minimum wage. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to talk, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Kramer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is your PhD in economics, or what is it?
Chair Holvey and Representative Kennemer, I have a doctorate in public health from St. Louis University and a master's in physics from the University of Michigan.
Thank you. I want to continue on, Mr. Chair. And that's helpful because I didn't understand, your comment was middle-wage jobs went away. And I think, indeed, they did back in the 80s. And I think that's because we devastated the forest industry and pretty much bankrupted all of rural Oregon. So I think it's quite a different thing from they went away. I think we chased them away. I guess the second thing is you talk about the impact of this trickle-down, and I wanted to follow up on Representative Barreto's comment. So if we can put so much money in the economy, it seems like $12 or $15 would not be enough, and I'd like to hear your response, given your perspective on this. Okay.
Thank you. So, Chair Holvey, Representative Kennemer. To your first point, the data that I just quoted from about the state economist, that's just in reference to the most recent recession. And so most of the jobs that were lost, in the 2008 recession, of course, were in sort of manufacturing and construction, not in the timber industry.
Yeah, but they were never replaced.
I You'll get no argument from me about that. But specifically, you know, the article that the State Economist just published on their website, you know, specifically relating to the you know, growth in middle wage jobs since the recession, relative to the number of that jobs that were lost during the recession. So that's what the 43% goes to. It doesn't refer back to the '80s and the sort of the larger kind of long term trends in the timber industry. So I just wanted to clarify that. So and then I now that I've been pontificating about that, I probably have lost the plot a little bit on the second question. So I apologize about that. So the your question is that what's the economic benefit of increasing the wage to $12 or $15 an hour? Is that?
I think actually it was more to the point of is $12 or $15 an adequate increase if you have this wonderful trickle down effect, which. Obviously, I don't believe that.
Okay, so thank you. So first, I guess I wouldn't think about it as a trickle-down effect. You know, I think that that language is typically reserved for things like, you know, people are arguing for, like, cutting taxes on capital gains or, you know, sort of giving more money to the wealthiest people in our society. And I think that, you know, what the evidence would show is that that's, I think that's been pretty roundly sort of debunked, that we just don't see the same kind of economic impact from policies that give more money to the rich. So so I guess I wouldn't characterize a minimum wage increase as kind of like a trickle-down sort of policy, where this is really sort of a kind of a rising tide lifts all boats. Yeah, I guess, you know, that said, when you look at the let me think how to phrase this right. The study that comes to mind is actually the chief economist of Moody's Analytics has testified in front of the U.S. Congress, looking at the kind of the relative benefit in terms of like economic stimulus of a number of different kinds of interventions, you know, including cutting taxes on the wealthy, you know, from raising benefits and so forth on people with lower incomes, and really across the board, it's those measures that help out people who have the lowest incomes actually have the greatest sort of overall economic benefit, you know, kind of across the country. And so I think that if we're sort of serious about making sort of the biggest difference to improve our economy, that it's those policies that really focus on improving wages and, you know, sort of incomes for sort of lowest income workers that we expect to have the largest effect. And I'd be happy to share that resource with the committee.
Representative Fagan.
Thank you. And this. Thank you very much for the panel. I do have a question for Daniel, because I think you might be the one to most kind of scientifically answer it, but certainly others chime in as well. There was a comment made in the previous panel that we need to separate the discussion of poverty and raising the wage, which obviously struck me as very counterintuitive, but I thought maybe you could speak to that in kind of a more data sense, because that just seems like an odd suggestion to make.
So Chair Hovey and Representative Fagan. So you know, I think that it. I guess I'd like to think I maybe share, you know, some of your maybe concern or confusion around that, because, you know, clearly these are all issues that are really interrelated. You know, it is hard to kind of single out any one and think that it's sort of operates independently of everything else that's going on. I think, you know, it's pretty clear that. That there's a strong relationship between low-wage part-time jobs and people who are sort of struggling, you know, in poverty or just you know, with low incomes. However, you kind of define that poverty line. You know, we know that there are hundreds of thousands of Oregonians who are working and just aren't earning enough to you know, to get by without state assistance. So, but you know, but that said, you know. As you know, Stephen mentioned, I believe that you know, there are lots of different things that I think we need to look at and think about as part of sort of a more comprehensive strategy to reduce poverty and improve the economy. You know, and some of these things are employment related, like raising the minimum wage, you know, paid sick leave, helping people save for retirement, and so forth. You know, I think there are other things we can do, like doing a better job investing in education and infrastructure and critical services. services. Those are other things that would help grow the state and attract businesses. So, so I really look forward to seeing those discussions happen and hope that I can help out as much as possible.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been listening intently to you three give your input and your take on raising the minimum wage. I hear about how you feel it's going to benefit business and whatnot. It's going to add money to the economy and so on and so forth. Have any of you actually started a business, maintained a business, grown a business? So you actually know what it takes to make that function and see the daily goings-ons of what hurts it, what helps it, all that kind of stuff?
Chair Holvey, Chair Hurd, Representative Hurd.
That sounds good. I like that.
Excuse me.
That sounded really good.
That's a wage increase. No.
Yeah.
To answer your question, yes. Not only as the state director of a small nonprofit, we have three staff people, and a nonprofit is a business as well, especially a nonprofit working with small businesses. We operate like a business. So, yes. And I have actually grown the staff of our organization from when I started one full-time staff person to now three. We're going to be hiring one more. So I do know firsthand what it is to run a small business. That said as well, all we do at our organization is work with and talk with and build relationships with small business owners who are working in the economy, who are working and investing in their communities. And what we're seeing is that small business owners look at running a business entirely different than large corporate businesses do. Small businesses invest in their community because they rely on their community. If a Walmart comes into an economy and it doesn't do well, they can shut down that Walmart and go build it somewhere else. If a small business comes into a community and fails because they're not investing in their community and they're not investing in their employees, they can't just pick up and move somewhere else. They can't absorb that into their larger cost. That's everything. And so we do. We do work with small businesses on a daily basis. And I'm not trying to say that every single person that we've talked to, in fact, I have said not every single person that we've talked to is supportive of this. But lots of times what it is taking the step back, and rather than just hearing all of the fear about the doom and gloom and how it's going to destroy all your business, if you take a step back and you look at the benefits as well as the costs, because the two sides of the ledger, we actually do see that the benefit outweighs a lot of these initial costs.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, based on that, Stephen, you said not all the businesses. What percentage of them are excited about $15 an hour minimum wage? Because I'm getting a lot of letters right now from small businesses across the state that are extremely fearful. And I'm not sure I would agree with those numbers unless the ones in city are a lot different than the ones out in the rural.
Okay. Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto. I don't have the exact percentage of the numbers who said 15 is the right number. We've been having a large conversation and have actually taken a step back and said, okay, well, what does an increase look like, and what does the number mean for you? And there's some business owners we work with, $12 is the right number, some 17 is the right number, some 25 is the right number. And so from an organization, we've, as our steering committee, got together and supported $15 by 2018. We think that the phase-in is really important for a lot of these small businesses who are scared about looking at, well, gosh, what does it look like to go from 9.25 to 15 tomorrow, and taking a step back and saying, that's not what we're looking at here. We're looking at an increase over time so you can work your way up to that point.
Follow up on that? Just real quick, could get me a list of those businesses, because I have not had one contact me that says, yes, that's a good idea. So I would like to hear from them, and then I'd like to visit with them.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, I'm happy to do that.
Thank you. One last piece of just listening to this whole issue about the economy and trickle down. And, as we've looked historically at our economy and have seen the ups and downs, and certainly when we see these up periods where we do see, increase profits on Wall Street and, our economy growing, when I look at the statistics on wages, they don't necessarily seem to follow. It seems like over the last 25 years, they've basically been flat at best. And so at what point do we see that trickle down theory lift those wages up
historically has that happened? And I guess the other piece of that is, why do we have a minimum wage that goes up every so often in the first place?
So, Chair Holvey, to answer the first part of your question, I think if you're waiting for those record corporate profits to get shared with workers, you might be waiting a long time for that. I think we haven't seen it happen yet, and probably, you know, I think for a large part because there's not a, there's really no requirement, a certain level. Those decisions are made in a kind of the corporate boardroom, and those profits are going to shareholders and not to the people generating them for the most part. I'd say it's probably sort of broadly recognized that just sort of this whole notion of kind of like this trickle-down economics, is pretty widely debunked, and I don't think it just doesn't hold water. It hasn't panned out. And then your second question around why does the minimum wage go up, or why does it need to go up? Is that did I understand that right?
Yeah. Why do we have one to start with?
So that's a good question. There's been a minimum wage for a long time, and you go back, I think, to 1930s or even before at the federal level. Reality is when you without a minimum wage, you're going to see a lot of people who are even a lot more people who are working for essentially pennies, and there's by setting a floor, you at least ensure that that people who are working can can at least be assured of some level of pay. And it's a I think if we look back 100 years at the kind of the plight of sort of working people, before those measures were taken into effect, it's pretty dire. We kind of hear about Dickensian time. These are minimum wage is a really important policy to really improve the lives of working people.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. I've got two more people to speak, Piper Sweeney and Eric Fruits. Good morning. Welcome. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Piper Sweeney. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about the effects minimum wage would have on our family farm. Our family owns and operates Country Heritage Farms. We grow about 2,000 acres of marionberries, grass, filberts, clover seed, radish seed, wheat. And our crops are a part of this quality that Oregon is known for. When we, when we send these to our processors, we, we're doing our best to bring the best produce forward. But these crops require many hours of hand labor. We have 13 year-round full-time employees, and then we hire 15 to 25 more seasonally. And we try to hire high school students for our berry harvester. I think it's a good opportunity for them. It's a good opportunity for us. At $12 or $15, we would have to stop that. It's they are still kids, and to actually earn what that would require, it would be prohibitive. We generally pay our employees more than minimum wage, but the increase would bump someone who just starts to a level that, of course, if you want your employees to feel that they're appreciated and well paid, that has to bump everybody else up. So my $12 and $15 an hour people, then they're going to go up to, I'm thinking my $15 an hour people would go between $17.25 to $19.50. So an annual yearly payroll of $600,000 would go up $90,000 to $180,000 in my estimation. $90,000 to $180,000 in additional costs for us. Where is that money going to come from? As a farmer, we are price takers. We don't set our prices. Someone sets them for us. For example, in our Marion berries, we don't find out what we will get paid for those Marion berries until after we have hand-trained them, put all of our input costs in, and shipped our berries. And usually anywhere from a week to a month do we then find out what our final price is going to be. And if it's too low, it's too late. We quit growing broccoli in the 1990s because we could no longer afford to grow it. We had summers where we lost money on broccoli. So that is no longer being grown. They could hand trim it and ship it here from Mexico for less than we could grow it. And that was heartbreaking. A couple other things I wanted to cover real quick. For example, this year, Marion berry price is looking to be very low. And that's frustrating to us. And it's low because they're going to be importing Mexican toupees, berries, and Chilean brazos. Now, we don't know how badly this will affect us until long after all our inputs are in. We're already struggling to compete in the world market and cover the cost of Oregon's annual wage increases. Farmers can do well, don't get me wrong, we can, but every year we take that money and it all goes back in, to pay for all these costs. And then, you know, if everything works right, then we get to farm one more year. So to try to cover costs like $90,000 to $180,000 in our payroll is just, I just don't think we could do it. I think what would happen is a certain amount of mechanization, certain amount of cutbacks. We're already thinking about getting rid of sweet corn. There's no margin there. We got rid of beans last year. So those are the kinds of things. And certainly cutting the workforce is one of our choices, and it won't be easy, you know, to do that, both for the people that work for us and have worked for us for a long time, and for us as well. During this current session, we're facing the potential for requirement of paid sick leave and other proposals that would increase our operating costs. In addition to that, we're trying to, you know, keep every OSHA regulation. That is costly for a small business. Our processors are asking us to be GAP certified, good agricultural practices. Very expensive to put those things in place and keep them working. Adding this minimum wage is a killer. It really is. And our margins aren't big enough to absorb it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Holvey, committee members. My name is Eric Fruits. I'm a Portland-based economist. I have a PhD in economics. My research has been published in top-tier academic journals as well as in The Economist and Wall Street Journal. I just circulated a report that I did on behalf of the Oregon Neighborhood Stores Association regarding a prospective minimum wage increase. I wrote that before the legislative session began, so it's more speculative based on a $12 an hour minimum wage, but I think a lot of qualitatively speaking, a lot of those findings are still valid. There's an old expression, and that old expression is no good deed goes unpunished. I hear it all the time, and I seem to live it more than I'd like to. This minimum wage measures that you're considering, they are a good deed, but they also pack a lot of punishment, and they punish the people that you're actually trying to help. I know it sounds perverse, but that's kind of the freakonomics of the minimum wage. If you look at Oregon, over time, over the past 30 years, we have had some of the worst unemployment in the country. Right now, it's actually better than it has been relative to the rest of the country, but that's only because the rest of the country is doing so bad. If you look, we've had relatively high unemployment, and our labor force participation is dropping faster than the U.S. as a whole. And that's if you look at the entire group. Now, if you go to a younger age group, to our youth, 24 and under, you'll find that youth unemployment is about 5 percentage points higher than the U.S. as a whole. We have worse unemployment among our youth. If you look at our labor force participation rate among our youth, it's gotten worse, too. It's much worse than the U.S. as a whole. And so you've got two things going on. You've got our young people, when they look for work, can't find it.
And then they give up and they drop out of the labor force. We are building an Xbox army of couch pilots.
Agreed.
Now, this isn't some crazy coincidence, and it's not some episode of Portlandia where young people are coming here to retire. This is because we have policies in our state that make it very hard for people to hire, and make it very hard for people to hire those who are inexperienced and young. And a big part of that is our minimum wage. If you think about that, raising a minimum wage to $15 an hour, I have a 16-year-old son. I love my son, but he is not worth $15 an hour. And it's not just about the young. It's about the unskilled. It's about the elderly. It's about the disabled person. It's about someone just trying to get their life back on track. And this isn't just me saying this. As a matter of fact, most economic evidence, and you'll see in the report that I sent you that I try to heavily cite it. I try not to put in too many citations because some of that research that I cite actually reviews a lot of the literature. But if you take a look at the U.S. Congressional Budget Office, last year or the year before, did a study on the minimum wage and found that it would cost about $550,000 jobs. And that's just raising the federal wage to $10.10 an hour. Now, if you think about that, that's, A, smaller than what we're talking about here today, but also we're talking about a national minimum wage. And when you talk about a national minimum wage, it's harder for businesses to move their stuff across state lines. You will always find bigger impacts if you raise a state minimum wage because businesses operate in a multi-state and multinational environment. They could simply move their operations somewhere else. We can also see this play out in some of the exhibits I've given you. You'll see that over time, wage and salary income, and I'm not talking about personal income where you have dividends and rents. I'm talking about wage and salary income has declined relative to the rest of the United States over time. And we see that in the other exhibit that that has worsened even though we have a steadily increasing minimum wage and even though we now have one of the highest minimum wages in the country. The minimum wage is doing absolutely nothing to help our decline in wage and salary growth. The minimum wage bills under consideration this legislative session will likely reduce total wage income in the state. The steep minimum wage increases being proposed would take income from one group of people and hand it to another group of people. And we're not talking about taking it from business owners. We're talking about taking it from other employees. Because as you have some employees getting a boost in their pay from an increased minimum wage, you will also find more people looking for work who can't find work or people dropping out of the workforce. You will see decreased employment. And a minimum wage increase on zero is still zero. And so it's very likely that the gains to those who will see the boost in wages will actually be more than offset by the losses to those who go from earning something to earning nothing. And if you look out there, the vast majority of people who are in poverty actually do not have a job at all. If you want to talk about people who earn minimum wage, a lot of times we like to focus on the single parent. Single parents make up less than 1% of the workforce earning minimum wage. If we want to deal with poverty among single parents, there's a lot better ways of dealing with it than raising the minimum wage for everyone in the state. Another thing we need to keep in mind, and this has been pointed out by some people who are actually who are pushing the higher minimum wage, we're talking about boosting the wages of about 550,000 people. That is one-third of the workforce. This isn't just the little increase that we saw this past year that affected, I think, 8% of the workforce. We're talking about one-third. And so we have to ask ourselves, is raising the minimum wage a big deal or is it not a big deal? In this case, it is a big deal. And when it has a big deal with some possible positive impacts, it's a big deal that will have some possible negative impacts, too. So you have my research. As I said, that research was finished around January. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, an article came out in one of the top-tier journals, so top-tier that I'm envious. If I wrote that article, I wouldn't be here today. I'd be in my tenure-track position at some university. It's in a journal called the Journal of Political Economy. As I said, it's probably one of the top four economics journals. The title of the article has a great name. You don't have to write it down because I'll say it. It's "How Effective is the Minimum Wage at Supporting the Poor?" And the author's conclusions are stunning. He finds, and I'm quoting here, "The costs imposed by the minimum wage are paid in a way that is more regressive than a sales tax." So as much as we hate the sales tax in the state of Oregon because it's so regressive, minimum wage increase is worse. And why is that? It's because if you look at how that minimum wage is paid for, who pays the price of the minimum wage? Businesses pay part of it, but who really pays it?
Consumers.
Are the workers. The workers pay it. 25% of the minimum wage increase gets taken away by all of us here in the form of taxes. That's just money that's gone. The rest would then get fed through the economy in what we've been calling trickle-down, but it's more like trickle-up. And I've never seen anything really trickle-up, so we know that won't work, right? The way it works is that these people may buy more, may spend more. Notice we say spend more, because what they're doing is they may not be buying more because the prices are higher. Their milk may go up from $2.50 to $3 a gallon. They may find that their price of gas has gone up. They may find that dining out goes up. And yes, poor people do eat fast food, and they have to pay those higher prices. A big chunk, if not all of that money, will actually get eaten up by higher prices. And that's how this conclusion is reached, that the minimum wage costs are paid in a way that is more regressive than a sales tax.
And I need to wrap you up. I think we have time for just a couple of questions.
I'm not a rapper.
Okay. Good. Representative Barton, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for you, Ms. Sweeney. And I don't mean to put you on the spot. If you want to get back to me later, it's, you're welcome to do so. The mayor of Monmouth earlier this morning testified in favor of a proposal not so much to raise the minimum wage, but to lift the statewide preemption. And if that happened, I guess that Portland would probably join Seattle and San Francisco pretty quickly at 15. Maybe Corvallis and Eugene would do something else at 13. Would that affect your farm?
I don't know. I would have to look into that, but I will do that and get it to you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sweeney. You're in the agricultural business. Let's say that you live in Ontario, Oregon. You have 100 acres of onions. Across the river, 5 minutes away, is Payette, Idaho. You are required to give $15 an hour pay. The farmer in Idaho that has the 100 acres and the same amount of onions is required to pay $7.25 an hour. You have to pay for sick leave. The individual in Payette, Idaho, doesn't pay that cost. But yet, when you get those onions and you take them to market, you get the same amount of money as that individual that's right across the river. What effect will that have on an agricultural, agrarian-type business?
Well, it has a huge effect because, yes, we're going to say we're probably selling those onions for the same amount. And interestingly, the food prices will go up because the processors can pass along some of those. They can't pass along, you know, the full extent, I think, because people can't afford to buy things at that rate. But yeah, it's basically what it does. It hits our bottom line. And then we look at what are our costs. And that's huge for agriculture because, again, our margins are tight and our ability to set pricing is non-existent. So that is simply less money than you look at that and say, okay, what can we do without? Or what? And we have probably at least three places we could potentially mechanize. Definitely not all of them, but there's at least three places. But those are working people that lose their jobs if we do that. And I heard someone say today that it's not always just an employer-employee relationship. We have people that have worked for us for 20 years. I mean, we're attached to these people, and to have that kind of a debate is a painful one. So, yeah, I mean, it would affect us in that we'd be cutting costs, and we'd have to look at everything, including labor, especially labor.
So, Mr. Fruits, can you point to any sort of economic indicators or indexes, whether it's the GDP or the S&P 500 or the CPI that shows that wages have kept pace with any of those other measures over the last decade, over the last two decades, three decades, four, five, pick your decade?
Well, I think if you take a look at my report, though, I think one of the best ways to take a look at it is how have Oregon wage and salary income per worker kept pace with the U.S. as a whole. And we find that back in, I believe, 1990, the average Oregon worker made about $500 less on average than the U.S. as a whole. Today, we're at minus $3,500. We make $3,500 less on average per worker than the U.S. as a whole. And this, again, has been during a period of time what we've
didn't
seen.
Answer my question, though. If you could find some data for us that shows these economic measures and compare it to wage levels, so we can see how wages have or have not kept pace with the economy, that would be helpful for us.
I
know,
oh, sure.
I know you must have that kind of data.
Oh, yeah. We can find that.
Committee, we're out of time. I apologize for going a little bit over. Thank you so much for testifying.
Thank you.
This morning. Appreciate it. And with that, I'm a committee. We will be meeting this evening at 6 o'clock for the public hearing. And so I'm going to recess the House Committee on Business and Labor until 6 p.m. It is 6 p.m., right? I've just written too many of this one.